Welcome to All Sides Weekend. I'm your host, Claire Roth. For many of us, trips to the meat counter are rote. Pork chops, flank steak, boneless chicken breasts. But for those wanting to get more up close and personal with their dinner, options for specialty meat cuts are becoming more popular. This weekend, 1400 Food Lab, a test kitchen on the West Side, is hosting a class on how to break down whole hogs and cook various pork cuts. Go to wosu.org/allsides for more information. Lindsay Teeter is the co-owner of Six Buckets Farm, a swine operation in New Philadelphia. She's hosting the class this weekend. She joins us now on the program. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So for those of us that might not quite understand, what is the appeal of cutting apart a hog?
That is a great starter question. Well, growing up, obviously, I spent 33 years of my life never looking at the inside of an animal. I grew up on pork chops, sausage, bacon, and had no concept of where in within the animal those cuts came from. So as my husband and I, as we started raising these hogs and becoming more intimate with them as far as learning, how they grow. We watch them born, we get them to market, and then we care for them for months, and then we send them off into the great unknown. We drop them off at the slaughterhouse, and we have no clue what happens to them afterwards. So that was the appeal for us personally. There was too much mystery. We would get back these cuts, and we had no idea what parts were trimmed, what parts were kept, what was wasted, what was kept. So we started bringing those whole animals into our home.
And for those of us that aren't farmers,
right, that will not appeal to everyone. Not everyone grows pigs.
Not necessarily. But if you said to me, you know, here's like a pork loin, point to where on the pig it is. I would have no idea.
Right. And that's, I think, something that a very basic life skill that's missing from especially a lot of our younger customers. We are not satisfied with that mystery. We're not satisfied with the anonymity of our meat, where it comes from. We just have so much access to so much cost-effective meat and pork. We can go to the store at any point, bring that home. People are kind of over that. They want more. They want more information, and they want to feel more connected to their meal and feel like they're a part of the whole process.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming a hog farmer. As you mentioned, you were not associated with farms.
No.
You didn't necessarily grow up in fields or in barns. So how did you come to this?
I am still trying to figure that out every day. Even as I introduce myself as a hog farmer, I'm like, really? Is that how does this? But I was saying, I blame my husband entirely for this path in life. But I did. I started out as a journalist here in Columbus. Proud EW Scripps School of Journalism alumni, waiting for that call from the Association magazine to follow up. We were looking for a home, and we lived in Clintonville. I wanted to stay in Clintonville, and he, as we were looking for homes, each trip would drive me out a little farther and a little farther past 270. He tricked me. Got me out in the open air and the clear skies, and I just kind of fell in love with it. So
so you get out to New Philadelphia. How do you decide from there, okay, we're going to start raising pigs?
Let's be hog farmers.
Yeah.
Well, actually, we lived in Mount Vernon before we moved out to New Philadelphia. We just had what I would call a hobby farm, about 10 acres. And we had no experience with livestock or animals or even living in the country. So the learning curve was very steep, but one day, the pigs, they found us, I always say. We were out mowing the lawn, and a little pink piglet that had fallen off of a truck, we still to this day don't know where it came from, ran into our yard. And my infamous words were, "Go get that pig," to my husband, to which he complied. And we had a pig. Hilariously, we called the shelters and we called the extension, and nobody knew where this pig was. Nobody wanted to take it back. And all of the advice that we got was, raise it. You live in the country, build a fence, raise it, and in 6 to 7 months, you'll have some bacon. So We did.
That's what you did.
We did. We had so much fun. We decided to do it again and again and again and again.
I was going
to
say, what about that singular experience then expanded out into, okay, right? Let's do this 100, 1,000, many thousands more times over.
Right. Man, it was, I had never been involved in that process before. And it was not, I did cry when it was time to send the pig on. I formed a relationship with this animal. When you're breaking up ice in the middle of winter, you know, you're giving it plenty of hay to keep it comfortable and to make it happy. And then one day, you know, that relationship has to end. And I thought of all the different ways that, you know, justifications for keeping a 300, 400 pound animal. I thought of all the reasons that we didn't need to send it off. But ultimately, those animals are raised for food and they wouldn't be domesticated and they wouldn't be so kind and friendly and appealing if we had not raised them for food for millennia before that. So, yeah, it was just really cool. I missed the relationship with the animal once it was gone. And I did. It was a whole new world for me as far as when we got that animal back. And that's part of our motivation for holding these classes. All these different cuts that were not pork chops. They were not, you know, ribs, bacon. There were whole chunks of meat that I had to Google and learn and to appreciate how to cook it right. And I just felt like I had been cheating my whole life by eating meat and not making that connection.
I was going to ask, how did raising your own food, quite literally, change your relationship with your dinner plate?
I definitely am a better cook now. I waste a lot less. And it just, if you don't eat meat, this always just has to sound so weird. When you make a meal out of your friends, you value. I feel like our portion sizes are smaller now. And it's really just about a appreciation. There's a lot more appreciation and reverence almost for dinner. You don't want to mess it up because an animal that was once running around in your yard is no longer with us. Freudian slip there saying lard, but yeah. So I think my reverence leads to taking more time to prepare it, honestly, and making that, you know, no one likes to cook anymore, but you feel like you owe it to that animal to make it a good one.
For those of us that are never going to raise a hog, I can say with fair certainty, although you know, I'm sure you
I said that
in your 20s felt
be
like
careful
you
young say. Lady yeah. You never know what you're going to run into out
but
there.
You know, for those of us who really do not believe we'll ever raise a pig, do you think that there is a way for us to gain that sort of appreciation, to gain that sort of reverence, as you put it, even if we ourselves are not going to, you know, be a farmer?
No.
We're hopeless. Okay.
No, next question. No. I'm being ornery. It's difficult, but I think, you know, if you come out, we open up our farm to people who consume our products, or anyone really. We value that connection. So you need to probably get in the car and drive past 270, hang out with a farmer. And a lot of folks tell me that they follow, you know, we're posting on social media, obviously, that they're kind of getting a glimpse into that world through our eyes. Now, be careful with those curated photos of little piglets and, you know, cute puppies. And
I was going to say, when
not
I was
the
on,
whole story.
When I was on your website and I saw these adorable photos of pigs, I'm like, oh, that's so cute. And then I looked over and I'm like, oh, there's the bacon.
The inevitable end, too. Yeah. No, there's a... Yeah, we do curate that sometimes. There's a little bit more manure than we let on sometimes. But spend as much time on farms as you can. And thankfully, with the trend of local food supporting more small farmers, then there are more options. It seems like there are new farms every day. And that makes me so excited because that means there's, you know, more time and more opportunity for people who don't live on the farm to at least get a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. You're at least 5 years in to this journey.
Mm-hmm.
What has surprised you most as you've gone through it?
The journey of farming or butchering or...
The whole thing.
Surprised me most. Well, Yeah, but yeah, like I was saying earlier, writing is my medium. Let me go think about that for 20 minutes
and come back with a thoughtful answer. An essay question. When you were starting to, you know, actually do the butchering, you talked a little bit about the emotional connection of mm-hmm. it. Help us understand, you know, physically what it's like,
right.
What some of the people will experience on Sunday.
Right. Well, that class might actually be postponed by snow, but the actual breaking down of a pig, there's a moment in each class where almost everyone, I don't want to say scream, but when we are separating the hogs in what are called primals, big chunks of meat, Flintstone style, we separate the shoulder and the belly. And when you slice through that meat and you can actually just fold the whole chunk over, you don't even actually need a saw or anything to split this section in half, but it's hard to describe without seeing it. But as soon as you make that cut, then you can instantly see the pork chop and the belly. And that is just a moment that was exciting the first time I saw it, when it all clicked and made sense. And it's just really cool to see a different group of people view that.
It's that light bulb moment.
Right. And it's, I think, for whatever reason, it's butchering an animal is something that no one knows how to do. But we've, as humans, been doing it a very long time. It's not difficult. So I think it's very intimidating to a lot of people. And when they see me, a relatively small person, cutting into there and revealing this magic, then it's a lot more approachable in that moment. You start to recognize those pieces as well.
Lindsay Teeter is the co-owner of Six Buckets Farm. It's a hog farm in New Philadelphia. She's sticking with us. We're talking about butchery and meat this hour. If you have a meat question, a meat pro tip, we would love to hear from you. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides Weekend. We'll be right back. Welcome back to All Sides Weekend. I'm your host, Claire Roth. We are talking about meat and modern butchery this hour. Where to find the best products, which cuts to try, and how to prepare them. This weekend, the Test Kitchen 1400 Food Lab is holding a class on how to break down a whole hog into cuts. You can find out more info on it at WOSU.org. Still with us is the leader of that class and the co-owner of Six Buckets Farm, Lindsay Teeter. Thanks for coming on, Lindsay.
Thanks for having me.
And Aliza Green is joining us. She's the author of The Butcher's Apprentice. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the program, Aliza.
Hey, great to be here.
So you are a prolific cookbook author. You're a chef for many, many years. You've been in the business for so long. How common are butchery skills, either in the home kitchen or even more broadly? Is this a lost art?
Well, in many ways it is, although we're certainly seeing a resurgence with places like Six Buckets, more artisanal butchers that are often raising their own animals, or they're buying directly from the farmers. We have a similar kind of situation in the Philadelphia area. So with Primal Cuts, a butcher shop that's open by a young woman, and, you know, she goes out to the various farms in the area. We have a lot of Amish farmers, so that would be a typical place. But for, you know, in the years past, I mean, my first chef job was in 1976, so I've definitely seen a lot of, you know, waves, come and go. But at one restaurant, I was a chef for 6 years, a place called Ristorante di Lulo, was Northern Italian, that was in the 80s, and we had a full-time butcher, Louis. All he did all day was It was mostly about veal because it was an Italian restaurant, taking the legs of veal and breaking them down. But every cut, we had that. And that would be, I think, pretty unusual. Maybe now, you know, we're starting to see it again.
That's actually how we ended up teaching butchery. We begged folks who do this for a living to do this for a few years. And everyone who knows how to do this is busy doing this. So we ended up kind of the lack of skill when we'd broken down hogs for a few years. Suddenly we were elevated to, unfortunately, you know, one of the more knowledgeable people about it. So that's how a journalism major ends up being a teacher of a whole hog butchery class. Hopefully we're solving that problem.
Well, absolutely, especially because so many of the supermarkets don't have butchers now.
Right.
They're buying the,
right,
you know, pre-cuts.
Prefabricated, I call
prefab,
it.
Prefab, you know, package, ready to go. So you really, you know, they can't even answer a question if you ask them.
Mm. Right. You know, something that you talk about so much in your book, Aliza, is the source of the meat, the animals themselves. What sort of impact does the way that an animal is raised have on it, the eventual product, and then also, of course, these ethical considerations?
Well, you know, that's the first thing is, you know, are the animals being raised, you know, humanely? Though that seems like a funny word to use about animals. But, you know, enough light, enough air, the right kind of food, being treated well. Living the best life that they can. And I have to say, my book, which is a combination of interviews with industry professionals, all, you know, kinds, and then step-by-step photos, you know, how-tos, the people that I encountered, the people that I got to know through writing this book, nobody cares about their animals more than the people that are raising them and that are, you know, getting up at 4 in the morning to birth a lamb or staying up all night for this or that. And they put so much incredible effort into, you know, and I'm talking, you know, I don't know too much about industrial farming. That's a kind of a different animal. but the, you know, those people that I came across, people that I've visited, they really care. And, you know, I mean, I deal with a lot of, you know, vegetarians and vegans in my day job as a catering chef at a place called Material Culture in Philly. It's an event space. But in any case, many of the younger people will come in and they say they're vegetarian or they're vegan and they don't eat meat. And I'm fine with that because, you know, we don't all need to eat a lot of meat. But what we do eat should be the best, least wasteful. And, you know, hopefully from animals that were raised to have the best life that they can.
That's something that really does fascinate me with, because in the research for the show and in talking to both of you, it does not seem that the people who are really on the cutting edge of this are saying
cutting edge. Ha-ha.
There you go. You know, are saying all meat all the time. They're saying be thoughtful about your meat and choose it carefully and then eat good meat when you decide to eat it.
Yes, and also, you know, no need for that giant portion. Why does a steakhouse have to serve a, you know, 2-pound steak? This is like, that's unfortunately America is so much about quantity and not quality, mm-hmm. And we're very wasteful. We didn't grow up we didn't have rationing like they had in, you know, in England in the war. We haven't had that kind of, you know, people not. We've had an abundance, so that leads to a lot of wasteful attitude, you know, hamburgers that are 3/4 pound or whatever it is. And I think that, you know, along with being able to, you know, have a more a humane way of life for these animals is that we're using all cuts. And that is something that I've seen a huge change from, you know, my early years as a chef, where the only cuts you would ever see would be a tenderloin of beef, mm-hmm. only beef cuts. You'd see a tenderloin of beef. You'd see a New York strip from the loin. You might see a T-bone or a porterhouse, and maybe a ribeye. The most exotic that you got was a flank steak. you would never be able to serve any of the slow-cooked meats. And most of the animal is slow-cooked meats, I mean, cuts that are suitable for slow cooking. So, you know,
I think
basically,
that's an appreciation as well that you develop. I'm lucky you develop that as a farmer when you see the animal in its live form, and you can see what muscles it's using and how that affects, you know, a muscle that is used more often is going to be a more flavorful, what we would call, I used to call tough, but now I realize I haven't been cooking it right my entire life and giving it, you know, the respect it deserves. But that's something else you gain from as you're raising these animals. It's you can eat all of the parts of it. And that's something that we try to educate our students who come in and learn. We downplay the loin and the high on the hog, the parts that everybody requests, because we think the flavor and the good stuff is those lesser known cuts. But I think, are they trendy again? Are they coming back?
Well, there's that phrase, high on the hog, and that's
right.
Literal.
Right.
I mean, people don't know. I mean, maybe you want to explain what that is.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, yeah, the loin is right along the spine, and it is kind of a freeloader. It doesn't do much work as my hogs are running up and down the hills. All the shoulders and hams are doing the work, as well as the trotters and the hawks and the cheeks, actually, chewing up all the forage that's planted out there. They're doing a lot of the work. And as a result, yeah, they're slowly packing those muscles and cuts full of flavor.
Mm. So high on the hog. So basically all high off the ground is the most tender.
Correct.
Interesting.
So
literally.
And then literally high on the hog. And then, you know, anything, the closer you get to the ground, so then the shank or the trotters, for, you know, which is what they say for hogs, is going to be the densest, but also by far the most flavorful.
This is All Sides Weekend on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about meat and butchery today. My guest today, Lindsay Teeter, the owner of Six Buckets Farm, a hog farm in New Philadelphia, and Aliza Green, chef and author of The Butcher's Apprentice. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also send us an email, allsides@wosu.org. And we have an email from Bob that really touches on the concept you were talking about earlier of using all parts. He says, you know, what does a beginner butcher do with hundreds of pounds of raw meat?
You do Googling first. You get on the YouTubes. And no. Yeah, it's not. There's so many resources. Even compared to when we started a few years ago, you can take any cut and find decent ways to cook them. So that's been very helpful. But you can also, you know, you can also make head cheese from a pig's head. You can, you know, parts that you would generally think, you know, should be ended up in the trash, the skin, the tail, all of these have a very good a very good ending in the form of a meal. And that's, you know, that's how we used to treat the hog. We used to value all of its parts, and we used to, the lard had many uses even beyond culinary uses.
Before we move on, I have to know, what is head cheese? You can't
it
just
needs
say cheese
more,
from
needs,
the head of a pig.
Right? It needs some better PR and a new name. Brawn is what has been referred to it before.
Brawn, right.
So there's cheeks and jowl. Within the head, there's a lot of usable meat in the head. Unfortunately or fortunately, the head is the most visceral reminder that this was an animal that a lot of people do not want to confront and therefore end up, you know,
just
not utilizing
discarding
it. Right. But there is a ton. I mean, it's basically ends up with pulled pork if you put that head in a giant stock pot and let it slowly cook. I know.
Is it
that's the
softer,
right face
and that's why they
first
call it cheese? I mean, do you know why?
So you,
or Aliza, do you know?
You cool it and you pull the meat off of the face, which is the part that most people don't want to confront. And then you put it in a casserole dish. And actually, that the broth that's left, you can cook that down until it ends up gelatinous goodness that you pour over the meat. And it makes kind of a meatloaf. Meat jelly? No, I'm not selling this for you. A lot of this. I'm just going to have to bring in some samples.
I was going
to
say, someone said, is she going to bring in a half a hog? I'm like, in my dreams.
Aliza, the day is young.
How do you go about that question? You know, someone wants to be a butcher. They get their hands on a large animal or a big part of an animal. Where should they start?
Well, I mean, I think the thing to remember, you know, yes, there are all those resources, but the principle is low and slow.
Mm.
So that meat should be, you know, the slower it cooks, you know, brown first or not brown first, and then, you know, maybe with some aromatics, you know, vegetables like onions and carrots and bay leaves and things like that to give it a little bit of mellow out the flavor. But that slow cooking, you know, turning every once in a while, and the meat is ready when you can pierce it easily with a metal skewer or a fork. It should just go slide right in. If you know, stick it and if there's resistance, then you know that you need to cook it longer. And it just needs a lot of patience. But, you know, the flavor that you get is really quite extraordinary. So, you know, I think that these days, in general, we're more about flavor. So if you think about cooking in other parts of the world where, you know, meat is quite precious, you know, yes, they're going to use every single part and they're going to use that to help to flavor other things. For instance, the first cookbook that I wrote is called The Bean Bible. So there's a lot of affinity between pork and beans. I mean, aside from the can of pork and beans, but that because like that, you take the skin of a leg. Maybe it's cured like a prosciutto, maybe it's not. But the skin has got a lot of collagen in it, which gives the gelatinous and that sort of mouth, the stickiness, which is richness in the sauce. Mm. So that piece will always go into a pot of beans because it's going to make, you know, the beans are now going to have the flavor, but they're also going to have some of that texture that is going to be imparted to them. Similar to, and that head cheese, testa, I'm not getting the Italian name right now, but walk into a supermarket in Italy and by the counter where they have all the salumi, the cured meats, which are almost all, certainly the great majority of them are from pork, you know, there'll be a head looking right at you. All stuffed, and it's just, you know, people around the rest of the world are a lot less squeamish than we are. And, I mean, it's just the way it is. You know, we're used to seeing that package of a, you know, we don't buy a whole fish because it has eyes looking at it. For the same reason, we're not going to get these other things that might be a little scary. So that head cheese thing, you know, great flavor, very, you know, good use of things, but not necessarily the first thing you want to do.
Well, so, and I think this brings up an interesting question. We're talking about, you know, meat all over the world, but even within the U.S., you know, does meat differ by region? Is there any advantage that we might have here or a disadvantage we might have here in central Ohio compared to any other part of the U.S. or I guess the world as well?
Well, certainly that was one thing about with my research and my other book, The Field Guide to Meat, which is a little kind of handbook. I did a lot more of that, which was really trying to compare cuts in different parts of the world and give equivalents. Although, you know, there's the two basic ways of breaking down an animal, the sort of what we brought over from England with the colonists, which would be chopping through bones. So that's a chop. A chop is chopped with a cleaver. So, you know, you'd have a steak with a bone or where you individually separate each of the muscles, which is more French style, European style, so that's seaming. So if you're going to have a chop, you're going to go cut right through multiple muscles. And that's why it works best for something where it's a very tender part of the animal. So even if it's multiple muscles, they're all basically tender. But if you get into a leg, or shoulder cut, or one of those, some of those muscles are very tender and some of those are very tough. So if you separate them out, then you have a much better use of each individual muscle to be at its best. And that's something that's happened particularly with beef. A lot of the cuts that we see these days, they didn't even really exist, or, you know, nobody cut them here that way, like flat iron steak.
That's really fascinating that we could have new types of meat, quite, you know, technically, because we're cutting them differently. And so they're going to taste different. Their textures are going to be different because they are, yeah, they are being taken out of the animal in a different way.
And from, excuse me, from the farmer's perspective, what an animal's diet, especially in the last month or two, definitely affects the flavor. So if, you know, our pigs are going to have a very unique flavor because their diet is very different from basically any other pig that's been raised, especially conventionally in Ohio. So they get a lot of nuts and grubs and grasses and even the exposure to sunshine. I always say that in part some flavor. That might not be backed up by science, but I'm going to say it anyway.
Well, and I was going to ask, your hogs are heritage hogs. What does that mean?
Right. That means they would get last place in every show across state and every 4-H competition. So they have not been, quote unquote, unproved, the breeds that we raise. They are sometime in the early 80s when pigs were moved into barns, the marketing department decided that they needed to compete with chicken. And so they bred pigs purposely to be leaner and leaner and leaner to the point where there's almost no back fat on a modern hog. But ours have, you know, 2 to 3 inches of fat. The fat is, you know, has not been demonized, and we're not fat shamers, we always say. So it includes, you know, we think that it contributes to a better flavor. So, yeah, they're fatter. They're more well-equipped to live and raise their young outside. So those are basically the main differences.
Well, and you think about hybrids. I mean, they're basically the modern breeds are hybrids, similar to what's happened with, say, wheat. You know, you have people that are, oh, I can eat those old kinds of wheat. You know, maybe they don't have the same health issues from older hybrid, non-hybridized varieties. Mm-hmm. So we have to kind of go back in time, which it sounds as though this is what Lindsay's been doing, to find the older breeds that haven't been, you know, because you give something up.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, that if you get a case of tomatoes and there are all those tomatoes where everyone is exactly the same size and you buy them by 5 by 6, you know, you buy them by size, not by variety or by taste or anything like that, you know that they're not going to have they've bred out the flavor. And the same thing happens with the animals. So if you're going to breed this super lean, dry thing, then you end up with a loin that is so dry, if you cook it, you know, fully, it's going to be like sawdust. And it actually, until, I don't remember how long ago, maybe 5 years ago, the USDA changed the recommendation.
They recommended you cook it until it was sawdust.
Yeah, to kill it. I mean, I'll kill it again until it's dried out. They said you had to cook it to 165 degrees, which is what you need to cook poultry to, you know, make sure of salmonella. But pork is now, they say, 145 degrees. Mm. Well, so that, you know, a pork chop that is pink in the middle, that's going to be juicy, and if it's in a heritage breed like Lindsay is raising, then it's going to have a lot of marbling, which is the internal fat. That's the fat that's mixed with the muscles. You have the other kind of fat that she's talking about, the back fat, is the separate fat, like the layer that encloses everything. And that you're, you know, going to cut away, or you're going to use it for various kinds of things, maybe making, you know, really wonderful lard. But the meat itself, the muscle meat, needs to have the specks of fat in it to have juiciness and flavor, because fat carries flavor.
And we're going to talk more about cooking meat and all sorts of ways of preparation coming up in just a moment on the program. Aliza Green, author of The Butcher's Apprentice, is sticking with us. So is Lindsay Teeter, the owner of Six Buckets Farm, a swine farm in New Philadelphia. If you have a meat question, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be back with more All Sides Weekend in just a moment. Thank you. Welcome back to All Sides Weekend. I'm your host, Claire Roth. We're talking about the art of butchery and how to prepare meat this hour. Lindsay Teeter is the co-owner of Six Buckets Farms. She's teaching a class on how to butcher a whole hog this weekend at 1400 Food Lab, a test kitchen on the west side. Thank you again for coming on, Lindsay.
Thank you for bringing me in out of the cold. I appreciate it.
If you have a meat question to ask or a pro tip to share, we want to hear from you. Email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also call us 614-292-8513. Also still with us by phone, the author of The Butcher's Apprentice, Aliza Green. Thank you so much, Aliza.
Well, thank you.
So in your book, you go through so many different forms of meat work, from creating cutlets to boning royal short rib to creating a crown of roast pork, which I have to say looks very impressive. What's the advantage of doing all this cutting and chopping at home versus going to the supermarket and picking something out from under the glass?
Well, go to the supermarket and pick something up. It's going to be very limited cuts. There's a lot of kind of drier, less fatty cuts from the leg, and also shoulder cuts with multiple different muscles that are like if you have a chuck roast. So that unfortunately, the quality, and you know, as a I go to the supermarket like other people, but I also have access as a chef to you know, buying far better quality. And you know, the difference is that the lesser quality meats go to the supermarkets, unless you're going to go to a specialty butcher, old-fashioned, maybe in an Italian neighborhood or something like that, where they have particular connections, they're buying direct. You're going to get in the supermarket's going to be industrially farmed animals, and the quality is, it's very difficult to make a really great-tasting thing unless you have better quality meats. But also, you know, one of the things I wanted to say was that you can get a bigger variety of cuts if you want to do it, you know, going to buy things, by choosing the market according to the major ethnicity of the customers. So that if you want to get pig trotters, a lot of times the market that has a large African-American clientele might have that. Maybe a German clientele would have that. You know, kind of think about what cuisine uses something like that.
Or in Grandview, Ohio, we have a butcher shop that we sell to regularly.
Well, there you go. Or you go to
butcher
a place
and grocer,
that has,
little plug,
that has a, you know, they have those personal connections, and that's where you're going to be able to get, and also somebody who knows what they're talking about and cares. I mean, I think the caring part is really important. But if you want to go, if you want skirt steak, a really good quality skirt steak that needs to have a nice amount of fat around it, you're going to go to a Latino market where it's called fajita for skirt, you know, same word. Actually, their word is fajita is fan. So fan and for them and skirt for us, but kind of the same idea.
Yeah.
And well, then if you want hanger steak, which is, you know, very popular bistro, French bistro cut, you can go to an Asian market, particularly a Korean market. That's the cut that those people really like, so that's what they're going to carry. So you can, you know, get more variety by opening up to going to maybe not just the, you know, the save lots of money supermarket, which is, you know, I always feel like a supermarket that puts the dollars first in their name, it's not going to be where you're going to get the quality. So buy less, buy better. And buy from people you know.
On that note, though, for those of us who might not have the money to go to a specialty grocery shop and buy a very expensive cut of meat, do you have any suggestions for something we might be able to get at a supermarket but would be worth it to buy and, you know, properly cook, prepare a special way? Anything like that, Aliza?
Well, I say, I like for all pork cuts, any shoulder, like a pork shoulder, you can usually find a whole pork shoulder, either bone-in or boneless, in a supermarket. And, you know, cooking that whole and then taking the meat off of it and then using it to mix into, like, then it becomes a braised dish. That's really wonderful. anything that if you see a shank, a lamb shank is usually whole. A beef shank is usually cut straight across with, you'll see the hollow bone, the bone in the middle that has the marrow, the round bone with the marrow in it. Very, very flavorful, very delicious, cooking very slowly. But mostly things that I mean, in general, if I'm going to choose, it's going to be a shoulder cut from whatever animal it is.
Mm.
And that's kind of also, I guess, if you're looking to save money, if money is your number one concern, then it's a lot more economical to buy a whole side of animal from a farmer mm-hmm. like me. And if you put in the work to process it yourself, in addition to that appreciation and education and custom cut just for your family, you'll also, the cuts end up being very comparable to what you'll find in a supermarket. So that knowledge pays off in the end.
Yeah. We're talking about meat and butchery on this hour of All Sides Weekend. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513. Brock from Columbus gave us a call. He's got a question about being a thoughtful consumer. Brock, what would you like to ask?
Yes. Thanks for having me. So I was just curious. I see a lot of what words and phrases one should look for when they're purchasing things, like eggs, when they say cage-free, roam-free chicken, and beef, grass-fed. What types of similar positive language should we look for when purchasing packaged pork, and what things are more jargony or gimmicky? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks so much for your question, Brock.
Yeah, labels labels are tricky. First of all, it'll depend on your morals and preferences as to what exactly you're looking for. But when you put a label on something, that's the first step in distancing yourself from the farmer and the process. I know it's not realistic in every sense, but the sooner you can form a relationship with a farmer and know exactly, visit the farm and see exactly how the animals are raised, the better. Because there is, there's a premium for those labels. And when there's a premium price, then there's always going to be folks out there who are willing to skirt around that and cheat that just to get the price without doing the hard work.
Would another alternative be perhaps going to a butcher who you trust and who can help you
that
understand?
Makes life much, much easier.
Yeah, if you can't make it out to a hog farm
right.
yourself.
if that's not on your daily to-do list, yes. Find a butcher shop who butcher shops have become, basically distributors for the small farm and the local farm, and they come out to visit and do a lot of that sorting before they're willing to make a relationship with a farmer.
Wonderful.
And one thing is, maybe look for a friend to be able to share that meat, because not everybody might have a big freezer to be able to pack away the cuts once they're done. And also, of course, making sure that everything is really well sealed is definitely important. And in general, I don't like to keep any frozen product more than about 6 months.
Mm.
So, maybe you can, take turns, you can trade off and, have different, just to make it a little more approachable. But about how much would you're talking to? They do a half a hog.
Leah Lindsay, you do a half a hog in your class, correct?
Correct. Yeah, we have a couple different formats, but the most recent one will be a pair of students split a half side of hog and get to break.
And
it
what
down
are they
themselves.
Ending up with? Weight wise.
So. They'll probably, we waste very little during these classes. We take mm-hmm. home skin, bones, fat, and everything. So you're looking at probably 80 to 100 pounds on a side.
Holy guacamole.
Right. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. So then, to share that, maybe you have a little club. I mean, a lot of people that I know in the Philadelphia area would do something like that.
And it goes faster than you think. It sounds like a lot of meat, but you can, as a family, you can go through a half a hog.
And you were asking about also back to the, what cuts to look for in the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a huge range of quality level. So, mm-hmm. One might be, have a really good, and something else might be, really not so good. But Short ribs. Short ribs are going for, you know, a little bit more money these days, but really delicious. Be able to, you know, slow cook them. A brisket, which is a front cut, is also wonderful. I'm talking here beef for the most part because I figure Lindsay can talk more about the pork. bottom round, which is a, you know, tougher from the leg side, but all of those would be something that you would cook slowly in a braise.
Mm.
Think braise, not roast, because roasts have to do with middle meats, where those loin, everything that runs along the back, is for something that can be cooked more quickly, or it can be another quick cooking. If you want something quick cooking, and I have to say at home, if I'm going to cook beef, it's almost always skirt steak.
We've got one more question, and I want to make sure we get to it. Megan has called, and she's actually got a question about game, which I think is interesting because we haven't touched that much on non-beef, non-pork mm-hmm. cuts mm-hmm. today. So, Megan, what's your question? Please tell us quickly.
Hi. So I am starting to get more into game meats as more, again, for sustainable meat products. But I'm having difficulties finding resources on cooking these meats. It almost feels like it's an afterthought in a lot of, like, cookbooks, online, you know, recipe things. I was wondering if your guests had any good resources that they could turn a novice game cooker towards.
Well, you go to Hank Shaw has a blog, honestfood.net, and he's a specialist in game cookery. His book is Hunt, Gather, and Cook. And he hunts all of the meat that he uses, but he's a kind of a modern guy. So his recipes are, a lot of the game cookbooks are really old-timey. And you can find some good things, but maybe not with the sort of international spicing and things that we've come more accustomed to. So I would recommend that.
When I'm advising students how to, as we're breaking down the pig and advising them how to cook different cuts of meat, I feel like a broken record sometimes when I just say, salt and thyme brings out the flavor in all cuts of meat imaginable. Now, with game, it would be lean. So you would, a lot of times I actually recommend adding some type of pork fat and skin, wrapping those leaner roasts with that is one of the uses. So you'll want to make sure you find a braise or some way to keep it moist. But yeah, there's a lot. Every time my brother-in-law cooks a deer roast, I feel foolish for working all of this time to raise these animals when they're already in the woods. So, yeah, that's something I'd like to get more interested in.
We really only have about a minute left, but I'd love to just ask each of you briefly, very quickly, you know, what's one thing that you would encourage us to try as meat eaters, either when we're going to the butcher or when we're preparing at home? Just about in 30 seconds or so. Aliza?
Well, salt the meat, not the sauce that Lindsay just talked about. Very important. So nice, even. Kosher salt is good for that. Gives an even coat without being overly salty in one place. And also bring the meat, if you're going to do something that's a slow cook, bring the meat to room temperature before you put it in the oven.
Mm-hmm. Important. Lindsay?
And if I haven't sold you on head cheese yet, then I would just recommend start easy. Go with, there's a muscle along the line of along the neck of a pig. It's called the Kopa muscle. It goes from the neck to the shoulder, and it is full of connective fat and tissue and one of the most flavorful parts of the pig that almost no one knows about when they come into our class. So give the Google Kopa.
And keep
an open mind.
Lindsay Teeter, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Lindsay Teeter is a co-owner of Six Buckets Farm. It's a hog farm in New Philadelphia, south of Canton. She's hosting a class this weekend on breaking down a whole hog. You can find out more info on it on our website, wosu.org/allsides. And Aliza Green, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And if anybody has further questions, they can email me at spice@alizagreen.com.
Perfect. Aliza Green's a chef. She's the author of The Butcher's Apprentice, the expert's guide to selecting, preparing, and cooking a world of meat. This has been All Sides Weekend. The All Sides staff includes producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon. The All Sides interns are Ray Brewster, Macy Glockner, and Sophie Warner, with video production by Rich and Amber Blue. I hope everyone has a great weekend. Thanks for listening.